Dear friends of Jesus Christ, this is not the easiest text to preach. This episode of the golden calf, it sits right in the center of the larger story of God making a covenant with his people. It's right in the heart of where God and the people promise allegiance and loyalty to each other. Now, it's placed there which seemed to underscore that the threat, the danger of disloyalty, apostasy, is an ever-present danger. That there is no honeymoon of innocence. That this fall here mirrors humanity's fall in the garden. It lays bare how the human heart, when it grows impatient or restless or bored, can turn on a dime and turn its heart to Egypt. To get the full impact, to find a way into the story, let's remind ourselves of the larger story, which in fact begins back in Exodus 19, when the people enter the wilderness of Sinai, and God says to Moses that he is to tell the people that you have seen what I have done to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now therefore, if you obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession out of all of the people. Indeed, all the earth is mine, but you shall be for me a priestly kingdom and a holy nation. You shall be, God says, a kingdom of priests. You shall be a kingdom that mediates me to the world, that represents me to the world. You will be a holy nation. You will be a people who are to become exhibit number one of my just reign. And then in chapter 20, and we looked at that last week, God gives the Ten Commandments and introduces himself by saying that he is the God who took them out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, and he tells them, have no other gods before me. And do not make for yourself a graven image, for I am a jealous God. And then we read this. Moses has gone up the mountain. The people have said they'd rather have Moses have his conversations with God and come back to them with God and God's instructions, rather than having God thunder his word to them in person. So Moses is gone, and we're told that when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people gathered around Aaron, who had been left to take charge while Moses was gone, and they said to him, come, make gods for us. Now, my Hebrew is very poor, but in the commentaries, I read that the word God, Elohim, is a word that's a bit like the word sheep. It could be singular or plural, depending on the context. So here, when the people say, make gods for us, the context would suggest that they in fact are asking for one God, right? God, come, make gods for us who shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him. Now, one of the phrases that recurs a number of times in this passage is who brought us up out of the land of Egypt. Here the people say, Moses did it. Then later, God confirms that and speaks to Moses as the one who led them out of Egypt. But then when Moses responds to God, he reminds God, you were the one who brought them out of Egypt. Anyway, that here the people say, Moses, the man who brought us out of Egypt. And so then Aaron says to them, take off the gold rings that are on the ears of your wife, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me. And there's an immediate response. There's a great, the most successful drive in the history of the church. So they all took off their gold rings from their ears and brought them to Aaron. And he took the gold from them and formed it in a mold and cast an image of a calf. And they said, these are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. Now this making of a golden calf, in Psalm 106, it's further defined as a bull calf. And the bull was a significant idol in Egypt, and again in Canaan, representing Baal, representing power and reproduction and fertility. The making of this golden calf, I mean, what lies behind this? What is it that drives people to make for themselves idols? And we mentioned something of this last week, but it seems to me it's important to simply stand here for a little while and ponder as to the reason for the making of the idol. And it seems to me that what idols have going for them is that they are there to satisfy our needs. They meet our needs rather than turn around and make their demands on us. You can always know that you're worshiping an idol when the God you serve seems to agree with every opinion and action that you undertake. Idols are that kind of gods. They're more manageable. They're there to satisfy the desires of your heart. They are gods who have in some ways become diminished, domesticated, more tame. Lynn Vanderzee, who has a sermon on this passage, talks in his sermon about golden calf religions. And he says that they are a threat not only among conservative, but also among liberals. He says that this golden calf religion raises its ugly head in the health and wealth theology that is in the church. A theology that says that if you are obedient and if you do this or that, God will reward you royally. You are the child of a king, and so you should live royally. And so if you will bring your money to the collection plate, I will pop a golden calf just as you wanted it. You serve God for worldly benefits, a health and wealth theology. It reduces God to our servant. There's the theology among the liberals, in the academia, where theologians and pastors are eager to please those who have a very limited notion and belief in God. And they will scale down their God so that it meets the approval of the academy. And so if the world can't believe in a God who works in history, then let this God be a helpless outside observer of history. And if they can't believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, then let's talk about him as a religious genius or a social rebel or see him as one who brings great wisdom to the human predicament. And if they can't believe in the resurrection of the dead, well, let's talk about a revival of the spirit or a springtime of the soul. But let's not talk about the invasion of a new kingdom and a new reign and a new creation. Reducing it all so that we can find approval among those whose approval we crave, whose accreditations we need so badly. Idols, reducing God so that this God serves us. Now, Aaron, he's an accommodator, a nice guy. He wants to please his people. The people want to get something out of these worship services. So let's build a golden calf, if that's helpful. And he wants to save the day, because once he sees that the people have asserted that this is the one who brought them out of the land of Egypt, then Aaron saw this. He built this altar before them, and Aaron made a proclamation, and he said, "Tomorrow we shall be a festival to Yahweh, to the Lord." He wants to see this calf as a stand-in for Yahweh. And so they rose up early the next day, and they offered burnt offerings and brought sacrifices of well-being, and the people sat down to eat and drink, and they had a terrific time. They rose up to revel. Aaron, you know, this accommodating, it is the temptation that every preacher faces. You know that, right? And in a consumer's culture, it is not wise to not give people what they want. Because if they don't get what they want, they'll go elsewhere. Eugene Peterson refers to this passage when he talks about this clamoring that worship, we want something out of our worship. And on the one hand, I'm thinking, well, of course you want something out of your worship. There's nothing sinful or evil about that. It depends what you want out of it. But if it's just to have a high, say, or to settle down so that you can do your work better, if it's not to repent, to commit your life one more time to serving God, to take up the cross and follow him, then we're asking of the worship service what could easily be mistaken for a worshiping of an idol. Anyway, the people, like I said, are having a terrific time. They drink, they eat, and they revel. But in the meanwhile, and this is such an interesting thing, really, it's sort of a split screen. But while the people are dancing and perhaps going into a frenzy up in the mountain, there's a whole other drama being played out. And there we see God angry and Moses pleading for the future of the people. Now, you know, there's something that's off-putting. I must admit it. You must have felt it when you read it. God described as someone who is hot with anger, who's thinking about consuming Israel. This anger, this wrath. You know, I remember I was greatly comforted once in seminary when Henry Staub, who was our professor, talked about wrath as fundamentally being God's resolute opposition to sin and evil. I could go for that. It's the kind of thing that you'd say the physicians and the healthcare workers in Sierra Leone are resolute in their opposition to the Ebola virus. They'll give it not a square inch. They'll want to do everything they can to eradicate it. They hate that virus. And we say, rightly so. And God hates sin as a virus, because he knows how destructive it is. And I can understand that. And we can cheer that. Now, this human portrait of God, really, it's very anthropomorphic. But we must not reduce it and make it a cold picture. Because we would be throwing the baby out with the bathwater. There is something deeply profound about the anger. It tells you something that I think we can identify with. Namely, that God here shows that this relationship, this covenant that he has made with his people, that is later very much defined as a kind of marriage, that this is not something that he is wanting to have broken. He hates anything and everything that worms its way into the depths of that relationships and gnaws at it and empties it and destroys it. And it's simply a fact that God is not limited to the disobedience of his people in carrying out the work that he wants to do, namely to bring about a new creation. If this people will not do it, if this church will not do it, if the church in the West will not do it, then some other people and some other church in another place in the world will carry out the message. The anger, it is, here's something. Anger is born of love. I mean, in some sense, anger is the other side, the flip side of love. You become angry when that which you love is being harmed, being threatened. You know, I have been in the ministry long enough to have witnessed a spouse coming to me and raging and crying, raging that the other one has deserted her or him, has been unfaithful, and crying at the sadness that this all brings. I mean, that God would be angry is a testimony to something deeply profound, that he is vulnerable. He is vulnerable to our disloyalty. God loving his people is hurt by their straying from him. It is a picture that is worth keeping. Yesterday, I came across a review of a book, and it's in the New York Times, by Edward O. Wilson. You guys know him? He is a biologist, a naturalist, one of the big names. He was for many years a professor of biology in Harvard. He's now 85 years old, and he's written his sort of last will and testament. It's entitled The Meaning of Human Existence. And basically he says, it has no meaning. Human life is ultimately and fundamentally pointless. Here's what he says. Well, in the review, they first refer to Stephen Hawking, who says humankind is just a breed of monkeys on a minor planet of an average star. Take that as a picture. But here's what Wilson says. He says, Earth relates to the universe as the second segment of the left antenna of an aphid sitting on a flower petal in a garden in Teaneck, New Jersey, for a few hours this afternoon. That's what we are. The second segment of the left antenna of an aphid sitting on a flower plant in a garden in Teaneck, New Jersey, for a few hours this afternoon. Now, Wilson hates religion. In the book, according to the reviewer, he sees religion as poisoning everything. And I think you give them to drink what you've offered here, and you will destroy us. If we are no more, as a planet, as a people, no more than the second segment of the left antenna of a plant lice, it makes no sense to me. I mean, then you know how you'd handle Ebola. You'd spray a large enough section to get rid of it, get a clean margin, and call it a good day. As long as I live, I hope till I die, I will take the picture of God angry and weeping at our rebellion as a picture that is true. And each of us has to choose this day by what picture, what reality you and I will live by. Do we see ourselves as little more than a breed of monkeys? Little more than the second segment of the antenna of an aphid? Or do you see yourself as one who has been called into a partnership with God, into a covenant relationship with God, to live life that is holy, a kingdom of priests, a holy nation? You know, what's also so fascinating in this is this thing that God then says to Moses, you got to leave me alone. Leave me alone. And Brevard Childs, who is just a top-notch commentator, says that this is one of the most startling and revealing things in this passage, because it says that God does not feel like he can carry out his anger and his judgment as long as Moses is making his appeals with him. And again, in human relationships, people will sometimes be so angry and you're trying to calm them down. And they say, leave me alone, just leave me alone. Let me do what I want. Let me hate. Let me do what I want. And Moses is in some sense, it's so dynamic. Moses is wrestling. Moses will not leave God alone. John Calvin, who of course had some real challenging moments with this passage, says, what does this mean? Is it not that unless God should obtain agreement, this is what Calvin says, is it not that unless God should obtain agreement from a human being, he will not be able to freely execute his judgment? In this way, he declares his high estimation of his servant, to whose prayers he pays such high deference, such high respect, as to say they are a hindrance to him. Hence, we do plainly perceive, Calvin says, the wonderful goodness of God, who not only hears the prayers of his people, but allows them to be intercessors with him. Moses becomes the model of the intercessor. He storms the gates of heaven, as it were. And we ought to, like Moses, hold God to his promises. We ought to say to God, God, you said that if we are faithful, that you would give us your spirit and you would do greater things among us than what had been done with Jesus. You said that if the harvest is ripe and we need workers, that we should pray for workers. You said you would be with us. To pray with you know, and Moses in his prayer, he doesn't say, well, these people aren't so bad, or, you know, you have to understand, you kept me away from them a long time. He doesn't make any excuses. What Moses does is he argues with God. He says, is it reasonable? Is it reasonable? You're the one who brought, for the first time, the truth is out. You're the one who brought them out of Egypt with a great hand. And then secondly, he says, what will the neighbors think? What will the Egyptians say? What kind of a God is it who takes his people in the wilderness and then lets them be consumed? And then finally he says, and remember the promises that you've made. You've made promises. You've said to Abram, Isaac, and Jacob that you would make of them a great nation. And then we're told God changed his mind. He didn't change his heart. He changed his mind. He's still determined to bring about a new creation and to use his people to model that new creation. But he's changed his mind in not doing it by this people whom he brought out of Egypt. This intercessor. And you know, if Moses is the model intercessor, there is a greater Moses in Jesus Christ who intercedes for us and in whose name we intercede for one another. To be a faithful people, to be a priestly kingdom, a people who mediate the presence of God. That's what we need to be working and praying for people. That in the life you live at home and at work and here as a community, that we become exhibit number one of holiness. So that those who say religion is a poison would stumble over their words if they were to encounter the church. To serve the God who made the heavens and the earth and who so loved us that he sent his son for us. To serve such a God with our whole heart and all of our strength and all of our possessions. That is a life worth living. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, amen.